This is Common Ground, a program on world affairs and the people who shape events. This week we travel to Tijuana's dumping ground, a place where a lot of trash and sometimes people wind up.
And I've often been asked, do you really think the Americans are going to bring garbage here? Because we'll be rich if you do. You know, because they know what we throw away, which to them is unimaginable. So there are visions of, you know, cast-off stereos and color TVs dancing through everybody's head here.
Common Ground is produced by the Stanley Foundation. I'm Mary Gray Davidson. Most visitors to Tijuana, Mexico, see only one aspect of that city. That's the side that caters to tourism. The beaches, the bargains on Tijuana's main street, the bars. Poverty is evident even where the tourists roam. Beggars ask for change. Children tug at your arm trying to sell trinkets, but they're easily shrugged off. Then there is another part of Tijuana that tourists never visit. It's the landfill on the outskirts of the city. The junkyard stretches for miles, filling in canyons and building mountains of trash. People live there. They build houses out of scraps they find, and they live amidst the garbage. They eat food found in the garbage. They die from the diseases and vermin endemic in a dump. Mexican-American author Luis Alberto Urrea worked for several years with a missionary group from San Diego to bring some relief to the people living in the dump. He's documented those years in a collection of essays recently published by Anchor Books titled Across the Wire, Life and Hard Times on the Mexican Border. Urrea and his friend Victor Harris, who still works for Spectrum Ministries, agreed to take me to the dump. After passing through the city of Tijuana, we arrive at El Dompe via a rough dirt road. Victor brings the ministry's van to a stop on the edge of a small squatter settlement, just a couple hundred yards from a mountain of garbage. It's an improvement over 10 years ago, Luis says, when people actually lived in the trash. We get out of the van, attracting the attention of children playing nearby. We begin walking toward the garbage.
And there's an interesting thing in between us and the garbage dump, which is a cemetery. It's quite sprawling. And to our left, which is to the north, is sort of the regular cemetery, where people bury their loved ones. And to the right is sort of a potter's field for children, for extremely poor children that can't be buried in a cemetery or can't, you know, family can't face funeral costs. They bring the children here and bury them. And you will notice if you look up on the hill that a lot of the headstones are actually cribs because they can't afford a headstone. So when an infant dies, the family brings the baby, buries it, sticks the crib over the grave, and paints a name on the crib. Sad. And up here to the left, as well as being just a general cemetery, there's spots along the edge where the city brings aborted fetuses and buries them en masse in huge sort of wax paper-lined cardboard boxes. If you look at the ground, it's interesting, they're running out of pure soil, so a lot of the people are being buried in a mix here of garbage and dirt, especially up toward the actual dump. I always say it's kind of a perfect metaphor for people who have to live here, because they live in the trash, die in the trash, and are buried in the trash now. So it's kind of a human refuse buried in garbage.
Where do the people come from who are living here and working here?
Well, a few maybe are locals, you know, but many of them are from Central in southern Mexico. A lot of them are from Central America. Many of them are just wanderers. You know, many of them came north not to cross the border, as we would assume, but just to do things like this. One of the dump dwellers told me once, at least you have garbage here. You know, back home we didn't have garbage. So.
Plenty of garbage here.
Yeah, and we were saying before you turned on the machine, one of the cherished myths here is that the gringos are going to start dumping trash here. And I've often been asked, do you really think the Americans are going to bring garbage here? Because we'll be rich if you do. You know, because they know what we throw away, which to them is unimaginable. So there are visions of, you know, cast-off stereos and color TVs dancing through everybody's head here. And it's one of the dreams they have here on the street level about the free trade agreement, is that it'll mean that the U.S. will dump its trash in Mexico. That's their fond hope here.
And, I mean, on the surface, it looks like it would be a plus.
Yeah, it would. But, you know, there's some really serious problems down here. One of the things that's happening with these strange maquiladoras, you know, the foreign-owned factories, is that a lot of American businesses are bringing down toxic materials labeled as construction materials.
And putting them in places like this
mm-hmm.
dump?
Yeah, and there's a really horrendous infant mortality rate here. Really, really bad. It's one of the worst in the world. And you know, a lot of that, I think, has to do with these hazardous materials that the women are exposed to. Certainly in the factories, they're exposed to mercury and lead poisoning, you know, to all kinds of awful things that they can no longer pump freely in Silicon Valley, so they do it here. A lot of birth defects, you know, a lot of hydroencephalitis and, you know, spinal cord problems with the infants and so forth.
About 200 families live in the dump at last count. Most of them sift through the garbage looking for recyclable material, which the owner of the dump then pays them for. A 100-pound sack of glass, for example, would bring around $1.50. Everyone in the family works the garbage. The young ones, though, are supposed to keep to the edges of the pile because it is very dangerous.
Everybody here works. There's no one employed. They work, you know, it's a true non-union workplace where they work for what they find, and that's what their salary is. But, you know, our natural inclination, I think, is to find it sort of shocking and shameful. But, you know, these guys are working skilled labor, and they're very well organized, and they support families with this. You know, it's a multi-generational job, and you inherit the knowledge from your dad or your mom. And, you know, this work, awful and smelly and dangerous and germ-ridden as it is, provides food and nourishment, provides school uniforms, clothes. Right now it's like being in Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds, isn't it?
Yeah.
We're being surrounded by a million seagulls right now. You know, and I personally can't imagine it, frankly. I mean, the smell is really awful. Even from where we are, it's awful. Imagine.
And then we're upwind.
I mean, we could walk in, you know, up on top of the hill, but it's really rather disgusting. And it's very dangerous, too.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people are killed there. It's very noisy up on top with all the tractors and trucks. And if you're working and you can't see these huge caterpillars coming your way, and they can't see you because they're, you know, 15 feet above. There's one now pushing over a wall of trash in the distance. They can't see you. And a lot of workers are crushed. And the dangers are many. There's a lot of disease, as you can imagine. And, you know, there are really no controls over what is dumped here. So there's a lot of very bizarre stuff in there. Dead animals and rotten food and weird medical detritus that's very disturbing. And you have no idea, you know, weird chemical stuff. So these people work at risk quite a bit.
And what's interesting is, I mean, this is a step up for a lot of people to come here, and it'd be quite a find.
Yeah, it is. I mean, if you are essentially starving or come from a place where there was literally no hope of survival, this is quite wonderful. You know, I mean, you can work. And there's dignity in being able to work, you know, even if it's something that you or I wouldn't want to do. This is like I said, it's a skilled labor. You know, you have to really learn how to do it, and you have to be strong. And there's a lot of pride in being able to do it.
Yeah, I see quite a few kids here on the periphery of the dump.
Yeah.
Is there a school around here?
Yeah. Yeah, there's school, but see, a lot of these kids can't go to school because they have to work to support their families. Also, you have to wear a uniform to go to school in Mexico, so if you're very, very poor, you can't afford the uniform, so you don't go to school. So this is an apprenticeship for these guys. Some of these guys are doing this so that, you know, there'll be somebody to carry on. You know, one of the criticisms you hear a lot about poverty in the third world is, why don't these people practice, you know, birth control and family planning? But I think one of the perspectives we don't understand in the United States is that what we see as reckless overpopulation is an insurance policy. See, to us, we see a family of 12 and say, well, they forced themselves to starve. But what they see is a family of 12 with a huge mortality rate. You know, three or four of them may die. The rest of them will work to provide the food to feed mother and father later on. It's a personal, look at this trash. Kind of spectacular.
Sort of a
garbage landslide. So they're providing themselves an insurance policy. There is no Social Security for them. You know, they don't have a bank account. They don't have a retirement. They don't have any kind of benefits. But they have children. So if they provide, you know, themselves with 12 kids, 8 of whom can work, then the family will continue. And that's how it works. That's part of the problem of overpopulation, I think, in the third world that we don't always comprehend. To us, it's a simple answer: take a pill or get a vasectomy or, you know, have a few hundred abortions and stop. But it's not that simple here.
And he'll take care of you when you're old, when there are no social services.
There is no one. You have only your own blood to look out for you. Oh, look, a woman up there has just found some nice shorts here. Just like shopping at Sears or something. And somebody's finding a cabinet.
You know, in the book, Across the Wire, you talk about people on both sides of the border, the more well-off who are unaware of what goes on here.
Yeah.
And the squalor and the tragedy. And you yourself, you grew up in San Diego, and were you any more aware of what went on here before you started working with the ministry?
No, I was aware, kind of like we are aware of the homeless. You know, you go out every day and you step over someone sleeping on the sidewalk. And I don't know what it is we tell ourselves about those people, you know, that they want to be there as Ronald Reagan thought they did or whatever, you know. So you're aware of it, but it doesn't penetrate your mind that much. Oh, look, we're about to be buried here in garbage. There's a nice tractor coming up above us right now. Yeah, that looks good. We have a front row seat for all the excitement here. But you see it and it doesn't register, you know, and no one frankly sees this. This is, you know, this is, it would be like expecting someone to go into the South Bronx to look around, or to, you know, to go into Harlem, or, you know, to go into any slum area and look around. We have, all of us in all societies, I think, have forgotten people. I think the shocking thing about this is that they're so forgotten and so desperately down and so close to the United States. You know, I mean, this weird life you're looking at is 10 minutes away from one of the richest regions of the entire United States. So the richest part, or one of the richest parts of the richest nation on earth, is literally sitting beside this, which is astonishing. You know, and I wish you could see what it looks like. I mean, you can sort of hear it, but it's an amazing sight.
Yeah, and you can't smell it.
Oh, boy. Fortunately, people would be switching off.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to Common Ground, a program on world affairs sponsored by the Stanley Foundation. My guest is Luis Alberto Urrea, author of Across the Wire, Life and Hard Times on the Mexican Border. It's a collection of essays mostly about the people who live in the Tijuana dump. Urrea came to know many of these people while working for Spectrum Ministries in the late 70s and the early 80s. We're bringing this interview to you from the dump. Well, one question that kept occurring to me as I would read the book, and the New York Times reviewer, I thought, was right in saying you have to read it in small doses because it's not easy reading. But I was wondering how you yourself live with the disparity. I mean, most people would shut themselves off from it.
It was terrible. It was terrible for me. It became quite a burden, and I think, look at this child running from the garbage. Ooh. Good thing she saw it coming. It took a real toll on me. You know, I didn't understand that I could quit at any time. I was so involved with these folks, and, you know, we're close, and some of them are family to me now. And after 5 years, you know, I was really, literally burned out. I was crazy. I really was. I couldn't sleep at night. I'd sit up all night. Nobody understood what we saw, you know. So, you know, I had my partners here, you know, like Victor and my buddies, and I could talk to. But outside of our experience, no one really got it. And a lot of people in our experience didn't get it. Because it's, you know, you're working with people who are essentially, you know, church people and are on a mission and have a vision, and they don't speak any Spanish. So it's one thing to be washing everybody's heads or feet or handing out beans, and it's another to be told 150 horrible stories a day. You know, and I was the one who had to go look at the blood and guts. I had to go look at the dead babies. And, you know, if we had a doctor, the doctor was a gringo, so I would have to go translate. So I would have to go look at, you know, whatever was to be seen, whether it was a gynecological exam, which I didn't want to be in on, or, you know, burns or whatever. And it just, the toll was huge. And I remember near the end for me, at night, when I would come home to San Diego, sometimes I would hallucinate. And I remember when I realized it was time for me to quit, we were driving back, and I think I was actually with him. But I was looking out the windows as we drove back into San Diego, and I was looking up on the hillside, and I saw huge bonfires that weren't there. And I saw fires on top of the bank buildings that weren't there. And I thought, uh-oh, I'm losing it. And a friend of mine was killed violently down here, a Mexican woman that I was close to, and I just knew, you know, it was it. I was finished. So it was hard. It was very hard.
Well, what I find difficult and probably much easier for people just to shut off is to explain why. I mean, why do people have to live like this?
Oh, gosh. I wish I knew. You know, I wish I knew. It's. I guess we really will have the poor with us always. You know, it's just, I think the shocking thing is that this time it's so close to home. You know, I mean, this is actually quite a bit better than the conditions people live in Manila, say, or, you know, the people who live near the body dumps in San Salvador and El Salvador. You know, this is actually fairly mild. But when you consider, I mean, this Christmas, aside from the floods we had here in Tijuana, which killed a lot of people, on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, 15 people died of exposure in Tijuana, which seems impossible because it's in effect San Diego. How could people die of it? But they did. In 1990, the first year I started doing Christmas drives here with a radio station, 14 people died on Christmas Eve, 8 of them babies. 8 babies died of the cold. And that seems impossible to believe. I mean,
it's warm down here.
It's warm. But this is a place, you know, where you're living in a shack made of paper, where you're living with a, you know, chronic cold, where any kind of disease can get you. There's no heat. There's no wall. There's no blanket, you know. So when the wind gets bad up here on a cold, cold, wet night, you know, you can get hypothermia, which people do, and they die.
You know, these people see us standing here, and there are some TVs and there's radios. They know how other people live.
Oh, yeah. They watch it every day. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's why they're coming across the border. I mean, you know, there's no way around it. People are going to keep coming. The whole world watches the United States every day. And we, frankly, live in Disneyland. Just being here and realizing that millions of people live like this, coming back to San Diego seems a completely different experience than when you left, you know. We have sidewalks. We have lawns. We have plants and flowers. We have palm trees and swimming pools. It's unbelievable. We have flush toilets. We have roofs. You know, we have pet food. So to the rest of the world, we literally live in Disneyland. And these guys know it. They live right next to Disneyland, and a lot of them want to come. And like I said, a lot of these folks don't. Many of these people aren't ever going to try to cross the border, but their children might.
As we continue our stroll through the Tijuana dump, Luis runs into a woman he knows, whom he calls Doña Palo. My other guide through the dump, Victor Harris, who still works for Spectrum Ministries, explains how they met. Our friends?
These are the people that I found. Their house had burnt down that I was telling you about.
That lived under the tarp?
That lived under the tarp, yeah.
That was right around Christmas time?
That was New Year's Eve 2 years ago. And they're just going home from work right now.
And they have a house now?
Yeah, they have a house that's built over in the little community where we started at.
They just invited us over to the house, so I think we can walk over there.
Doña Paula's house is not at all what I expect. There are only two very small rooms, and the furniture was obviously scavenged from the garbage. But the house is very neat. There are canned goods on the shelves, and school pictures of the children on the wall. One of her older daughters, Doña Paula tells me proudly, is even going to beauty school in Tijuana. At one time, 13 people lived in these two rooms, but several have now moved out. Victor explains that a little assistance from relief organizations has made a big difference in this family's life.
They were living under the tarp. We brought in some garage doors for them, but a Catholic organization came in and poured the cement floor here and framed up this house for them. And that gave them their start all over again, because basically everything they had was lost in the beginning at the fire. Oh, but now they're at the point, I mean, I saw out there they got pigs in a pen out there, they got a chicken coop out there, they're raising chickens, so very hard-working, industrious people.
Oh, a cement floor would make such a difference.
Oh, it does. Makes a big difference, because for one thing, your house doesn't wash away. When all the water comes down the hillside, it kind of hits the cement and hopefully goes around it, you know, but doesn't wash your walls down.
As we leave Doña Paula's house, she wants to show us around outside. There's the chicken coop Victor was talking about, the pigs in their pen. But what surprises me most of all, in the midst of this garbage dump, is her small fenced garden full of flowers in bloom. And Doña Paula insists on picking one of her prized roses for her visitors. Our drive back to San Diego is typical, Luis says, because no one ever has much to say after a trip to the Tijuana dump. As we arrive at the U.S.-Mexico border, we come to a stop on the Mexican side and wait to cross.
And this is the fabulous borderline where we are now. And a lot of times people cross the border right here under the nose of the Americans. What they do sometimes now is get these kamikaze runs where they collect a lot of runners and will storm the gates and run straight through on foot. And the U.S. agents will not follow them because it just will start a bloodbath. You know, you imagine 100 people running face first into oncoming traffic on the freeway being chased by speeding cops. It would be just a nightmare. So, you know, they don't do it. They just let them go.
Well, it's not uncommon for people to be hit running across.
No, a lot of people get hit. A lot of people.
There are 28 lanes of traffic backed up at the Tijuana border. The lines move slowly, and even here, people are trying to make a living, selling, begging, washing windows, getting whatever they can from the captive audiences in their cars.
Good, the traffic moves so slowly with all these little kids.
Yeah, it's a pretty dangerous world. I mean, if you think about it, these are little, tiny people. These children are no higher than the door edge, and they live, you know, 12 hours a day in a cloud of exhaust.
Yeah.
It's kind of frightening if you think about it. But you have to live. You know, that little boy there, he's got to be, what, 5 maybe? And he's earning money for his family. And it's hard to say no.
Doña.
I see an old woman like that who's selling these crosses, and she's just a sweet old grandma, you know, and she lives a life of utter disrespect. You know, people just, they deny her basic humanness. So that, I think that's what kills me the most, you know. You get to meet Doña Paula and you find out what a fascinating and really fine person she is, and realize that so many people will never know. You know, that's one of the things that drove me to write the book. They wanted to have a record of their life left behind because nobody knew. No one would ever know that they lived or how they lived, you know. So it meant a lot to me to... I felt I had a kind of a mandate to give voice to the voiceless, you know, and that... I guess that's why it surprised me that the book found some success, because I thought nobody would care. And then suddenly, you know, it just sells and sells in its little way, you know. Very gratifying.
My guest has been Luis Alberto Urrea, author of Across the Wire, Life and Hard Times on the Mexican Border. I'm Mary Gray Davidson. Common Ground programs are available on cassette. If you would like to order a tape of this program called The Dumping Ground, call 1-800-767-1929. Visa and MasterCard are accepted. We'd also like to know what you think about the program. Send your comments to us in care of the Stanley Foundation, 216 Sycamore Street, Muscatine, Iowa. The zip code is 52761. Again, that phone number to call to order cassettes is 1-800-767-1929. Our theme music was created by B.J. Lederman. Common Ground is produced and funded by the Stanley Foundation.